want to be happy, but I won't be happy till I make you happy too.
We all want to be happy, but I think Ella knew that right there in that old song lies the key. It's to make you happy too. Our spiritual traditions know that to be true, and now our psychologists are getting it too. I'm Rachel Kahn. Stick around for the good oil on what it takes to be happy. This is The Spirit of Things on ABC Radio National, abc.net.au/rn. Tony Grant is one psychologist who's got all the bases covered in the field of happiness because he's gone out and made a study of what actually makes Aussies happy. But even as a life coach, he's skeptical about overselling the possibilities, and he's concerned that the spiritual dimension of happiness is often overlooked. Tony joins me later in the hour. Well, for those of you who've long suspected the road to happiness is spiritual, it's often been paved with gurus sporting glittery turbans, crystal necklaces, and orange robes. But with Baram Gista, there's no paraphernalia. He dresses like you and me. In fact, he's not really interested in taking you out of your life, but putting you in it, with more quality, more peace, more joy, and above all, more knowledge of yourself. But how to achieve it? We'll meet him shortly, and a little later, one of his students, Brendan, tells us how Baram helped him sort out his unhappy life. Baram Gista, welcome to The Spirit of Things.
Thank you, Rachel. Thanks for having me here.
Well, Baram, you are here in Australia because you're one of the most celebrated spiritual teachers. And I want to ask you what you would say to someone who came to you with a lot of the obvious signs of success. Steady income, a good partner, lovely children, a beautiful house, but in fact was suffering, in pain, and unhappy.
Good question, Rachel. I'd say, how much time do you make to know yourself? How much time do you make to grow yourself? And often the answer is not much. I have come across a gentleman who was in a similar position as you speak of. And when I said, what do you do with your free time? And he said, actually, not very much. I don't know what to do with my free time. That's why I keep myself very busy.
Very busy. Well, that is the yes. sort of mantra of our modern world, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
So by keeping busy, what are people doing?
They're not getting in touch with their reality, which could point them in the direction of being wiser. So people are afraid of looking at themselves because they believe that what they will discover might not be very pleasant. They don't see that along with some unpleasantness, they will also discover their joy. Because people don't make time to understand this, they continue to defer their learning and happiness.
So is the premise then that being happy is actually in your power, and therefore being unhappy is also the consequence of what you do?
Yes, it's the channeling of your power incorrectly. For instance, Rachel, suppose you were to ask 1,000 people on the street or from different walks of life just what they really desired, what kind of answers would you get?
Oh, they would want a Lamborghini, a beautiful house with lots of rooms, perhaps a very large garden and a country house and perfect children and a partner who was always there with a bouquet of flowers.
Absolutely. And how many amongst these people would say that they would like to be wise?
Very few, probably. They would probably assume that wisdom kind of naturally just emerges out of being happy.
Yes, Rachel, but just having a piano in the house does not make you a pianist. And just having the ability to think does not make you a good thinker either.
Gee, so many people, though, buy those things, particularly pianos and keyboards, in the hope that they will somehow conquer this and be wonderful musicians.
Yes, but unless they make the time to learn the art, they'd never become wonderful musicians.
So where does one go to learn the art of happiness? Because after all, Baram Gista, you're not always around.
I may not be around, but there are many teachers in the neighborhood who are around to guide the people in the area.
Well, I guess it would be hard for a lot of people to know where to turn, who to trust.
Let me share a little story with you on this, Rachel. Many years ago, when I was teaching in Europe, I was interested to find an acupuncturist in Mumbai to help me with some leg pains that I had from sitting cross-legged for hours and hours. But I didn't believe that such acupuncturists existed in Mumbai. And so when I was in Germany, I asked one of my friends there if she knew of a good acupuncturist there. And she said, because she visits India quite often, she said, "Bairam, why do you want to take treatment here when you have great acupuncturists in India itself?" I said, "Really? I've never seen any," because I didn't believe. So she gave me the address and phone number of one person in Mumbai. So when I came back, I called the lady and she said to me, "Where do you live?" And I said, "I live here and here." So she said, "Oh, you don't have to come through the traffic to meet me over here. It'll take you an hour. There's a fantastic fellow right in your neighborhood." So I said, "Really?" And guess where he was, Rachel? 2 minutes away from where I was. And I never saw his sign because I didn't believe he existed. Same with people who are looking for teachers. If you don't believe that they are there, if you think it's very difficult, then that difficulty will be your reality. But when you are open, they will appear.
Yes, I think there's a saying like that. When the student is ready, the teacher appears.
Absolutely. Yes.
But, you know, just speaking of acupuncture, that's one of those Eastern arts of healing that sometimes works and sometimes doesn't. And it seems to me that in many cases, you almost have to be ready for that to work. If you're between appointments and rushing to a place and you ask someone to stick pins in you, after which you have to go and pick up the children, does it work?
I doubt it if it would, but this is the same with any kind of medicine. Even the best medicine will not work because the mind has such immense power to override the efficacy of the medicine if the person is not ready to heal himself or herself.
Well, you know, when I think of unhappiness and I think of people in pain, the typical reaction is to identify in the past who did it, what was the cause. I know it was his fault. I know it was this event. I can prove it to you. This is the story of my life. How does one get out of that frame of mind?
What we do not recognize, we cannot change. If we don't recognize our own involvement in the difficulties we experience, it's difficult to take a different tack to the situation. For instance, most people don't recognize the fact that when they are angry or upset with someone, the anger is not really related to the person in front of them. The anger is really related to their own inability to find an effective solution to the problem. That's what the anger is about. Most people don't recognize that. Because if the person wasn't centered, wasn't in charge of their own power and ability, there was no reason for anger to arise. There would be compassion, there would be understanding, there would be deeper listening, and there would be an amicable solution to the situation in front of us. So anger is not really in relation to the person or circumstance. Anger is in relation to our own inability to find an effective solution to the problem.
Is the key then to actually discover that in yourself you have a worth that is far beyond, you know, the travails and the problems that come your way, the things that you measure yourself against?
Yes, absolutely. But most people don't see the importance of discovering that worth. They don't see the importance of discovering the source of their innermost joy. And because people don't feel good enough of the time, that niggly feeling gets transferred onto all their experiences. So to feel good enough of the time, we have to make time to really discover our radiance.
Discover our radiance sounds so wonderful. Bairam, was that a hard lesson that you yourself had to learn in your own life?
Yes, Rachel, it was a hard lesson. And there's a saying that there are two kinds of people who come to the teachings, those who see the light and those who feel the heat. I was amongst the latter. It was when I felt the heat that I shifted my consciousness and started making time to discover my radiance.
And what was the source of that heat? What caused you to burn, as it were?
I've always been good at art, and I've got 2 bachelor's degrees and 1 master's degree. However, I knew somewhere deep inside that this was not my calling. Nonetheless, I trained in the field. When I was in the US getting my master's degree, I was in this very special college, an all-art college, which had music and dance and theater and film and video and art and design. And the deans of all the different 5 different faculties were all international figureheads. So much talent, so much power, so much money. They had reached the epitome of human success. And yet, when I looked closely at these people, I saw that not one of them was happy. That really threw me. That created a crisis in my life that, hey, Bahram, you heading down the same path, what is it that's going to make you happy? If these guys haven't discovered it, what will make you happy?
Well, were you actually plunged into a time of unhappiness yourself?
Yes, I was. The fact that my whole world was collapsing, I had thought that if I become a great designer, that would lead me to settle in the golden land called the US and be happy. But these guys were not doing it. So I asked myself, what is missing here? And what was missing was that they did not have a deep-rooted understanding of themselves. They did not have that spiritual intelligence which allowed them to feel satisfaction in their victories.
But Bahram, for you to have noticed that meant that you already had a spiritual intelligence, even if it may not have been full-blown.
Yes.
Tell me about your past and where you came from.
I was fortunate, Rachel, to have a father who was deeply interested in spiritual matters. He was an architect. When I was born, he was already posted in North India, in the Punjab, and he was mingling with lots of holy men, getting, you know what satsangs are? Meetings with holy people. And being an architect and having a senior position, we had a large home, and he used to bring these people, invite them over to our home for a chat to meet his friends. And I used to sit as a little child with my mom in the back, and I observed these people, and they had this amazing radiance around them. They had a glow around them, and there was something in their eyes which none of my father's friends had. As I grew up, I was more interested in discovering that light. At the age of 13, I started reading books on psychology to know myself better. And therefore, when I went to the US and I came across this difficulty, I was pointed back to those men who I had met in my childhood who had that glow, and I wanted to be like them.
Isn't your own family tradition Zoroastrianism?
Yes. We are Parsis. We live in India, originally from Iran. But for me, my inclination is more towards the Buddhist teachings.
Why did you find that Zoroastrianism wasn't enough?
Because I have not found some teachers in my own tradition who could explain the doctrine to me as clearly as what the Buddha has taught. There's too much rituals involved. Not enough practical, down-to-earth teachings.
Well, speaking of that, one of the messages that you give to your students, which you've written about, is learning to be fearless, unwavering in self-assurance. Wow, that's a very popular and much, much hankered after kind of quality these days. Was that something that you personally felt in need of, that radiant self-assurance?
Yes, Rachel. First of all, I'd like to just clarify that to be fearless does not mean that you do not have fears, but that you act despite the fears. You do what is right. So when I graduated from the US, I had this strong calling to come back to India and practice the Buddhist way. And I made a commitment to myself that I would not work. And that was a very big commitment. I was going to let life support me. And I was petrified of that decision that I made. And yet, I was willing to go through with that decision, to come back to India and full-time attention on the teachings, because only then could my mind open. So I have trained in monasteries in Sri Lanka, Thailand, and Japan.
And now?
I'm not connected to any Buddhist groups. I have my own community.
How would you describe yourself then? Because, I mean, most people who say they're Buddhist,
yes,
describe themselves as either Zen or in the Vajrayana Tibetan tradition.
Okay.
Or
I'm more connected to the Theravadan tradition, which is a southern school of Buddhism, practiced in Sri Lanka, Thailand, Burma. Yeah.
Mm. Well, practically speaking, these days, a lot of people who also would not want to associate themselves particularly with a monastic tradition, nonetheless want the benefits of a Buddhist life.
The message I would like to communicate is what the Buddha taught. And what he says on this issue is that if you really wish to be happy, stop desiring what cannot be attained. Which means that if you want to harvest mangoes, it's not a wise idea to be planting orange seeds. Because you don't get mangoes from orange seeds. In the same way, if we really want to be happy, happiness is not just an outside factor. It's more an inside factor. It's what we bring into the experience that counts and not what we just get out of it in a passive fashion.
Well, when I think of people today, we live in a society that has often been characterized as a sort of throw-out society. You acquire things, and when they break, you throw them out. You don't repair them.
Yeah.
We don't repair toasters, computers. Some people don't repair their cars. They just buy new ones. And I wonder whether that sort of attitude has spilled over into our relationships. You know, that doesn't work. I'm leaving.
Yes.
Have we lost the art of repair?
We've lost the art of nurturing, and therefore the repair is necessary.
Can you explicate that a bit more? How does one nurture?
One nurtures by understanding the process of what we wish to achieve. If we wish to achieve a healthy relationship with someone, we don't wait for it to fall apart before we try to repair it. If we wish to nurture a healthy relationship with someone, we make time to first of all love ourselves and then share that love with the other person. That's called nurturing.
Is that about learning how to enjoy?
Yes, enjoy what is there. Appreciate what is there. Be grateful for what is there in the moment. Not want for something else constantly. This desire for perpetual wanting is an illness of a kind.
Doesn't he have a warm voice? I can tell you it's matched with dark brown eyes that are like wells of solitude. Bhairam Gista is my guest, and he's a Buddhist teacher who's helping people learn to appreciate the great and the small riches of life. Later, we'll hear from one of his students who needed his help. I'm Rachel Kahn. This is The Spirit of Things on ABC Radio National. You can download it and look up previous programs on similar topics just by going to abc.net.au/rn/spirit of things. Now back to my conversation with Bhairam Gista. What are the ways, what are the practical ways in which one can learn to enjoy, to be sensitive to a relationship and therefore see it as always new, always interesting, always potentially full of joy?
To have a rich experience of anything, Rachel, we need to have a deeper understanding of it. A musician, for instance, will have a deeper understanding of music than a layperson would. An astronomer would have a deeper understanding of the night skies than a layperson would. A poet would have a deeper understanding of nature than a layperson would. So in order for us to really nurture and appreciate something, to have a rich experience of something, we have to cultivate that desire to know it in its fullness, not just a shallow experience. Most people, for instance, are attracted mainly to the physical form. They're not attracted to the spirit behind the physical. And so when this physical form changes, people's affections also change. And that is not the right way to go about things.
So we have to learn to be students of life,
absolutely,
as it were, moment by moment.
Dedicated students.
Is this where you teach people to develop their senses?
Yes, being mindful of what we are blessed with, Rachel. That in every moment we have the choice either to be laid back or to be more sensitive, either to be arrogant or to be more affectionate. So out of all the choices in front of us at any given moment, it is only the opportunities for fashioning a brilliant life that have to be seized. We should not be seizing those choices, those opportunities that keep us in our mediocre state.
Mediocre state. Well, that's probably where most of us are at. So to heighten our sensitivity to everyday things, can you give me an idea of how one can do that?
Okay, let me give you another example. Suppose I say I want to learn the piano, but I don't learn the scales. I don't go to music school. I don't even have a private tutor. But I just fiddle around on the piano, day in and day out. Will I be a good musician? Will I be a good pianist, Rachel?
Not likely.
Not likely. But once I get the teacher, once I get the training, put some dedicated years of practice into it, then not only will I produce some great music, I will produce enthralling music, most likely. Same with life. If we see life as a musical instrument, a beautiful musical instrument, the only way to make music out of our moments is to learn the skill, is to learn how to do so, is to invest time in learning how to do so. Otherwise, our moments are boring, restless, and we keep wanting something else.
Well, that seems to me like a full-time occupation.
It's a beautiful occupation. It's just like if you're really in love with someone, don't you want to spend as much time as possible with that person? That kind of love and passion for life and learning has to be there for us to excel in whatever we do.
Well, that's a very active solution. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering about another kind of solution. Recently, the BBC aired a series on silence in which people were introduced to this thing which they were very afraid of, which was silence. And a handful of people plunged into this experience of silence over a course of a couple of weeks, absolutely had transforming experiences. They profoundly changed their lives. And And it was an idea that was prompted by the notion that silence is the gateway to the soul.
Absolutely, yes.
And soul is the gateway to perhaps God or mm-hmm. divinity. Is that where meditation perhaps comes in the Buddhist tradition?
Yes, Rachel, it does. And the thing is that before we can even touch that silence, it's important that we do the groundwork for it. Develop the right personal qualities for that silence to emerge. Because when we're not really perfecting our qualities, well, then the mind remains restless. And no matter how much you try to be silent, it's impossible to do so. So expressing more kindness, more affection, more gratitude, perfecting these qualities is first the foundation. Then comes the meditation a little later on.
So you actually develop your character.
Yes.
Before you plunge into the long silences yes. of meditation.
Because if you're not really happy with yourself, and you're constantly restless and looking for something else, no matter how many days or months I put you in a cave to sit quietly, it's not going to work. Your mind will be elsewhere. But once you find that inner stillness, not just through the silence, first of all, but through acquiring the right qualities of kindness and gentleness and caring and understanding, then the mind settles down. Similar to someone who lives on a diet of junk food, which is empty calories. When someone lives on a diet of junk food, empty calories, the body will crave for more food. It's not absorbing it. It will constantly crave to eat something. But when you give yourself proper food, the body settles down. In the same way, first the mind has to be given the right nurturing, the right food. Then the mind settles down into that space of silence. And that's when we discover our divinity.
Gosh, how do people do that in the midst of their quote-unquote ordinary lives? For example, if you're married or have siblings and you've always behaved to them in a certain way, and now suddenly you're behaving to them in a very considered and gentle and loving way, people might run away in fear.
I don't know, no. They might come and hug you some more.
So it takes a bit of courage to actually change the way you interact, doesn't it?
Courage and the wisdom to see that we have no other choice if we want to be happy. There is no other choice.
You have quite a few students here in Australia, and I'd like to ask one of your students who's come into the studio today, Brendan Coutts. You've been a student of Baram Gistav for, what, about 10 years now?
Yeah, 10 years, yeah.
What kind of life were you leading before you met him?
Well, it wasn't a happy one. Before I met Baram, I had quite a lot of difficulties in my life. I had a child, and the mother of the child and myself, we had a terrible relationship. We were fighting constantly and causing ourselves and particularly our son a lot of pain. And I was studying and working in a career that really didn't interest me. It was quite, I just had no passion for it.
You have a scientific background, is that right?
That's right. I was an academic working in science and studying a PhD. And apart from all my, the difficulties I was having in relationships and career, when I look back, almost my greatest difficulty was that I was very, very intellectual. And I had this belief, I think, that if there are solutions to my problems, I'll be able to work them out. And since I couldn't work them out, I thought, well, it can't be my fault. It must be someone else's fault. And so I was sort of locked into this suffering and just thought, that must be just the way it is.
How were you comforting yourself? Where were you getting comfort in this kind of situation?
In bars. I was drinking quite a bit. And I was trying to squeeze some sort of happiness out of drinking and small friendships and that sort of thing, and just thinking that that's all that I could hope for.
Well, how did a scientific academic like you find yourself in the situation where Baram was holding forth, communicating his wisdom?
Well, I was lucky in my sister, who I have a lot of respect for, introduced me to Baram and I guess convinced me to go along and explore this way of looking at the world.
Were you skeptical at first? I mean, were you thinking,
was, yeah.
Don't want to go near a guru?
I was. And I have my history is also, I was raised Catholic and I was probably quite skeptical about religion and spirituality. And again, I thought, you know, I can work it out myself. That's all mumbo jumbo. But because I have such respect for my sister, and also because on some level I realized that I was miserable, I thought, I'll give this a shot. So I went along to a retreat, but yeah, quite skeptical. And something, yeah, quite profound happened to me on that retreat. I think two things, actually. And the first was, with some horror, I realized that these circumstances of my life, I was intimately involved in creating them, which I'd not been open to accepting that before. I'd thought that I was doing everything that I could, and why a thing's not working for me, it's not my fault. And on this retreat, one realization was that, well, I'm actually doing this. I'm creating this suffering for myself, but also for the people that I'm mixing with. And then the second thing that came to me in the retreat was this deep relief, in a way, that as I realized the depth of sort of misery that I was in, I began to see there's a way out. And this seed of hope was planted. And yeah, that seed was such a precious thing. I realized that through this path, there was a way out of the suffering that I was creating for myself.
And how did you then pick up the pieces, the tools, the wisdom of this path and apply it to your life?
Well, it's an ongoing process, but since then I've bit by bit, and essentially it's, I guess, my practice I see as just being more loving, bringing more love into my life. And bit by bit I've been practicing doing that and being more loving to the people around me. And it was funny to hear you say before about what happens when people all of a sudden start wanting to hug more and that sort of thing. And some of the people in my life were a bit amazed or shocked. But at the same time, once I got over that initial shock, it was a very welcome thing. And those relationships have improved, you know, dramatically. So there's been that practical thing of just being more gentle and more loving with people in my life, and also more loving and gentle towards myself. Then I've also developed quite a consistent meditation practice. And through the acting in the world with more love and having this dedicated practice, I've felt that seed of hope that was planted, I've felt it begin to grow in my heart. And more I'm feeling the experience of love in my life in a more consistent way.
And how has that affected your relationship to your child and the mother of the child?
So dramatically. I'm so grateful for having come across Baram because of that. The mother and I aren't together, and we weren't back then. But I look at people that I know in those situations, and perhaps even parents who are together, and I see the tension and difficulties and the unwillingness to work to respect each other more, and the pain that it causes in that family. And I can see that is the path that I was heading full bore. I was heading full bore down that path, and the suffering that would have been there for myself and for Anna and for Matthias, my son. I'm just so deeply grateful that we've been able to turn that around. And Anna and I, the mother and I, are actually really, we're not together, but we're very, very good friends and have a deep respect for each other. And I can feel that since that time, my ability as a friend and as a father is actually much more than at that time I actually realised it could be. Mm. So I'm seeing more than I even knew was possible.
Did you change your job as well?
Yeah, I was, as I said before, I was studying science and had no interest in it. And since then I've explored other areas, and I've moved from that into, more recently, I've been working in a management area, which perhaps doesn't sound an area that people associate with being more loving.
But it could be.
That's exactly it. I see that the business world is a world that is crying out for more acceptance and compassion, and it's actually a profound tool for more effective businesses and more joy in the workplace. So I have moved into that field, but I can feel myself moving away from that as well, and I'm drawn towards something where I'd like to work more directly with people and support people to know themselves better and to experience the benefits that I've experienced through coming in contact with Baram.
And Brendan, are you more comfortable with spiritual language now than perhaps you might have been before as a science academic?
Yes, no, very much. It was funny when I first started, I think at the first talk I went to with Baram, there was some chanting at the start of the talk, and I had this strong resistance. Oh, what is this chanting rubbish, you know? And now I love the chanting. So it's amazing to see how my mind is open to the beauty in those in that language and in those practices and in that world.
Do you see the chanting for its practical effects as well?
Very much, yeah. Well, there's a lot of aspects to it, but one is a devotional thing I can feel through chanting. I feel, again, greater love for divinity or whatever. Also, I just find, on a physical level, I find it good for opening my throat. And in opening my throat, I feel better about myself. I feel more confident and more centered.
Brendan Coutts is a student of Master Baram Gista, a Buddhist teacher who's helping people like Brendan to find a happier way of life, which includes work and, of course, relationships. Baram Gista is the founder of the Nembutsu Center in Mumbai, where he teaches, and he's also the founder of Inner Artistry, which has members in Australia. Coming up later, Anthony Grant, who established the first university-based coaching psychology unit, will tell us how it's the little things you do that can make you happy. I'm Rachel Kahn. This is The Spirit of Things on ABC Radio National with my guest, Baram Gista. Baram, a lot of Eastern spiritual practices focus on the self, and silent meditation can be a way of delving into it. In fact, today one could easily say, though, that there's a kind of epidemic of self-absorption, self-centeredness. And I must say I like what the 19th century writer Henry James said, and I came across this quote very recently. "True happiness, we are told, consists in getting out of oneself. But the point is not only to get out, you must stay out. And to stay out, you must have some absorbing errand." Now, wouldn't people benefit enormously if they were involved in something more meaningful to do with others than just focusing on the self?
Yes, absolutely, Rachel. And at the same time, just as they tell us in the airlines when we're on the plane, that in case of an emergency and the masks drop down, first we have to put the mask on ourselves before we can help other people. So in the same light, first, by getting our act together, healing the self, can we learn to be selfless and make our greatest contribution to society?
Do people often forget the second part?
Very often. And that's why a teacher is necessary to keep poking them in the right direction.
Into an other-directed activity.
Yes.
One that is not. Because, you know, when you keep focusing on yourself, you
yes.
can actually get caught into melancholy and depression and sort of almost a never-ending dark crevice one can get into.
Yes. And that happens when people focus on themselves outside of a learning environment. Because in a proper learning environment, we are taught not just how we sabotage ourselves, but also how to discover our strengths and to focus on those strengths and consolidate them.
You must see a lot of spiritual teachers who you're not so sure about. Are you prepared to critique, or are you prepared to give us an idea of the kind of spiritual teacher to stay away from?
In general, I would stay away from anyone who professes to have all the answers and who creates an exclusive membership of a kind, you know, that we are the special ones and we are the chosen ones. That kind of teaching and teachers we need to stay away from. Teachers who encourage us to learn from other teachers and to learn from life itself and other people, that's the kind of teachers we need to gravitate towards.
So would you say your students are permanently attached to you, or do they come and go?
They come and go. But there are some who stay with me, but along with the teachings they receive from me, I encourage them to visit other teachers, to make contact with other teachers.
How do you stay in touch with them?
Through the heart connection, primarily, and through email.
Email, yes. The new spiritual communication.
Absolutely.
Who would have thought?
Yes.
Well, I suppose then when you come in the inbox, you must have a totally different effect on people than all the other things that come in on the inbox.
I'm hoping so, yes.
Well, tell me what your retreat in Australia consists of.
The retreats every year that I offer in Australia, they consist of a deeper understanding of our strengths and how to apply them in our daily lives in a practical manner. It's about learning how to consistently choose the best within our reach. The best within our reach is our kindness, our ability to smile more, our ability to listen better, our ability to make a better difference in other people's lives. That's the best within our reach. Instead of choosing the pub, we can choose to read a book, for instance.
I get a sense that you're really trying to push into the background our tendency to be critical, to be pessimistic.
Yes.
The kind of culture of critique which we're so fond of. We even teach it to our kids in schools.
Yes. Just to be more open to life's beautiful moments, just to be more open for all the things we are blessed with, and to share our blessings with others is what the retreats are about. Making us more aware of just how rich we are in opportunities, how rich we are in possibilities, and how rich we are in faculties which are worth more than gold and diamonds, which we don't even use. We rarely use.
When you talk about faculties we haven't used, are you talking about
our ability to be intuitive, our ability to be insightful, our ability for foresight?
So it's about paying attention.
Paying attention to what amazing qualities we are blessed with.
And I guess also trust. And trust is very close to faith. And of course, in the Western biblical tradition, Christian tradition, one has faith in God. In the Buddhist tradition, is it more about trusting one's intuition, trusting one's senses?
It is trusting in the basic principles that lead to a flourishing life. And that is why on the Buddhist path, right understanding is of primary value. Trusting in the process that allows us to match our intentions with our actions. Because if our actions don't match our intentions, which is to be happy, we're not going to get to any happiness.
Of course, we have to be clear that our intention is to be happy. And I guess that's the first principle.
But just intending to be happy, intending to be a good pianist is not going to do it. We have to have our actions in harmony with what we're intending.
Well, Baron, I know that one of the ways you communicate your wisdom to your students is through stories. Can I ask you to tell one now?
Happily, I'd love to share one. Thank you. I was running a retreat center in the Himalayas for 5 years, some years ago. Brendan has been to that place. Beautiful location. Usually the people who came to my classes were travelers passing through. They would see the posters and then they would come and inquire and join the classes. So one bright morning, this Brazilian fellow comes in and he says he's seen my poster and he wants to learn yoga. So I said to him, well, why do you want to learn yoga? So he said, well, I've come to Manali because over here you get the best weed. And I've been smoking weed for the last 2 weeks and I have not had much exercise. So I want to stretch myself and I want to be healthy. So I said, have you thought of stretching your mind? So he said, what? How you stretch the mind? So I said, why don't you go and get yourself a notebook and pen and you come back to my class, which is starting in 2 hours. So he ran off and he came back. And just with that one class, he decided to stay for the whole month. And he forgot about his weed. And then after a month, he got the itch to go traveling. So I said, okay, see you later, buddy. And off he went to explore more of India. But he comes back 2 days later. He came back 2 days later and he said, oh, Baram, guess what happened? I was playing with some kids in the village and they picked my pocket. I've lost my credit cards. I've lost all my money and I have nowhere to go. Can I just stay in your center a little bit? Obviously, life had other plans for him. So he stayed for a few more months. And by staying long enough, Rachel, this man's life transformed magically, permanently for the better. Today he is such a happy person back in Brazil, in Rio, and he keeps in touch. And he talks about the time when he stumbled onto something he wasn't even looking for. So it's fascinating how life brings us into these situations when we least expect them to.
Well, I like that story because it shows someone who was first obsessed or concerned with his body. But actually, the real work needed to be on his mind.
Yes.
And in his heart. And that's something our culture, particularly where the focus is so much on the body, the mind and the heart are left behind.
Absolutely. And that's why the Buddha says, stop desiring what cannot be attained. Stop desiring happiness just on the body. You have to nurture your spirit, nurture your heart. That's where the happiness is.
And that can be attained, you're saying?
100%. You follow the process and you will make that chocolate cake.
But it's also a path that you don't just arrive at and suddenly you have it. It's a path that goes to the end of your life, isn't it?
And beyond.
And beyond.
So sorry.
Said as a good Buddhist.
Yes.
Well, Berim Gista, Brendan Coutts, it's been great having you on The Spirit of Things. Thank you so much for sharing your spiritual journeys with us.
Thank you, Rachel, for having us. It's been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you.
Thanks, Rachel.
Master Berim Gista and Brendan Coutts were my guests, shedding a little light on how to achieve happiness. It helps to be guided by a teacher, and in Australia, you can find out more by going to innerartistry.org or check out details about our guests by going to abc.net.au/rn/spirit of things. I'm Rachel Kahn, and this is The Spirit of Things on ABC Radio National. In my ear that you say when there's no one here, little thing. He set the challenge to 8 relatively unhappy people in Sydney's most unhappy suburb, Merrickville. Psychologist Anthony Grant gave them little things to do for others that could make them happier, all according to a scientific point of view. Professor Tony Grant established the world's first university-based coaching psychology unit at the University of Sydney. And, of course, my first question to him was, how do you measure one's quantum of happiness? What are some of the indicators?
I guess we can make it as simple or as complex as we want in terms of measurement. And, of course, it all really depends on how we define happiness. But let's leave that aside for one moment and talk about how we measure happiness on the Making Australia Happy show. We used a number of different things. There are very good self-report measures, you know, essentially questionnaires that people tick yes or no or how much to. There are many well-validated measures of subjective well-being, psychological well-being, and what we might broadly call happiness. So we used a range of those self-report measures, and I developed a scale based on validated measures that if you scored 50, you were sort of neither happy nor sad. And if you were below 50, you were more sad than happy, and the other way around. A very simple benchmark. But we also took a whole range of other measures, which for me were fascinating. We looked at, we gave them blood tests, saliva tests. We even gave them brain scans before and after. Well, they took part in the positive psychology program. What's more, we found not only did the self-report data improve, not only did their blood pressures tend to go down, not only did they have less cortisol in their blood, which is indicative of less stress, and better melatonin levels, but actually their brain states shifted as well.
Wow, and this is all due to positive psychology.
Well, as a psychologist and as a social scientist, I would be very hesitant to draw direct causal lines between participation in the 8-week show and, you know, the results at the end. But on the face of it, you'd have to say that the work that they put in into improving their well-being and engaging in the process really did pay dividends.
I would have thought that happiness measures are, to some extent, culturally specific or even personality specific, because I know, for example, that I'm happy when I work and when I know I'm useful to society, whereas other people might measure their happiness in the time they have off work.
Absolutely. And that's part of the nature of happiness, really. And that's why I think subjective well-being is a useful term for it, because it is subjective. And of course, there are variances across cultures and within cultures as well. What makes me happy may not make you happy. And I think that subjective aspect of happiness talks really about the impact the program had, because although there was ostensibly these sort of 8 steps that everybody did, you know, which was mindfulness, they did a gratitude visits, and we did altruism exercises and engaged in social networking and positive social network connections. What worked for one person tended not to work for another person. The strength of the program was that it was very individualistically based. So, for example, young Liz, who had a very, very busy life, like many of us, single mother, 2 kids, on the run all the time. What she found really worked well was mindfulness, was actually taking the time out and even cutting her vegetables in a mindful fashion. You know, people think, oh, I have to retreat to the mountaintops and go on this voyage of hair-shirted spirituality in order to be mindful and be present. No, actually, We just need to orientate our attention to the present. She found that very useful. Now, for someone like Ben, who was a young guy who actually had quite large debts, who was pretty lost in his life, what was important for him really was to engage with his life in a positive way, to take charge of his debts, to deal with his finances, to deal with the small things that he'd put to one side. And once he'd done that, that was quite a breakthrough point for him. So I think this notion of subjectivity and happiness is not just about our experience of it, but actually the route to happiness that we take as well. Very individualistic.
Well, given that the cases you've just mentioned are so individual, does it mean that a person really needs to find a coach who can sort of examine the problems that that person is having and come up with a regime, a set of activities?
Well, as a coaching psychologist, I would think everyone has to go out and purchase expensive coaching services in order to have a fulfilled life. Of course, that's a little bit of a tongue-in-cheek comment. There are some changes that we can make on our own, and people make great and important changes on their own. And there are some changes that really do need a bit of support. It doesn't have to be a coach. It can be a mentor. Some people use a spiritual or a philosophical framework in order to give them guidance and structure in that. And I think it's the guidance and the structure and staying on track that really helps, you know. If we have good self-regulatory skills, and many of us do have, then we can make positive change. Interestingly, I think that most people that make purposeful positive change of a meaningful nature do find that quite hard. There's a sort of a myth, I think, in the self-help industry that you too can have the life you live, you know. Well, actually, real profound change, either happens in an instance, that quantum change sort of transformational, that's rare. For most of us, actually, it requires quite hard work. It's a little bit at a time, plenty of relapsing, and then moving forward. And then that kind of case, having a coach, a mentor, or a sponsor, or some sort of program to work by really does help.
Well, since happiness is about the way you feel, then I imagine just being happy, just smiling, just being kind would deliver some kind of effect. And I note that in the Merrickville experiment, you were walking around actually with a counter to see how many smiles you got from people.
I have to say that the Making Australia Happy series was a lot of fun, a lot of hard work, but a lot of fun. We really had fun with the notion of happiness, you know. And actually, I think that's one of the key things is when we come to the notion of our personal well-being, our personal development, our personal growth, with this heavy air of seriousness, with this sort of, you know, profound gravitas, we kind of lose the joy of it, you know. And at the same time, there's a balance to be had between being too flip and too hedonistic and too yellow plastic smiley face and too overly positive. And I think it's really about us individually finding our own route. What's the balance for each of us, you know, and treating the subject matter with a bit of lightness.
What about your own story? You were a latecomer to psychology and coaching, but did you always have a knack for happiness?
I'm not sure if I have a knack for happiness. I certainly have a knack for having a stressful sort of day-to-day existence and trying to find that balance, like many of us. My background was that my parents were very much involved in a school of philosophy that followed the work of Gurdjieff, and they applied themselves in the late 50s and early 60s very much in that sort of early mindfulness sort of approach of being present in your day-to-day life. And for various reasons, I didn't find that extremely attractive as an ongoing way of life. But I think what I had from that was a hankering and a yearning for understanding some of the broader questions that we have in life. And I have to say the educational system failed me remarkably in that respect, in that I left school before I was 15. I became very disenchanted with the educational system. And I really only came to tertiary studies when I was 39 to study philosophy and psychology when I moved to Australia.
After having explored a lot of other spiritual pathways?
Spiritual pathways, recreational pathways, hedonistic pathways. There was a number of pathways on the journey.
Well, it sounds pretty balanced.
I had a lot of fun along the way.
Well, what are some of the best things you can suggest to people who really want to significantly improve the happiness quotient in their lives?
The pursuit of happiness essentially must lead to disappointment. And yet we need to recognize that yearning in ourselves, that need in ourselves in order to make changes. I love the paradox of it. The more you seek it, the less you find it. traditionally, of course, we've approached this as a species through religious and spiritual traditions. For various reasons, those aren't so prevalent in our society now. Consumerism has come to the fore, and science has come to the fore. And the science and the art of positive psychology certainly provides many tools for people to enhance their well-being. And a lot of that stuff really does work. You know, if you take the time to count your blessings, it sounds so crass when I say it, but actually to do stuff for other people, you know. If you take the time to do a gratitude visit.
A gratitude visit?
Yes, to write a letter of gratitude to somebody. You know, occasionally I get letters from students that write to me, and I can tell you just a short few lines talking about how their engagement in the courses that I run at Sydney Uni now, our master programs, affected not just professionally but personally. It makes so much difference, you know, it's unbelievable. And I know that when I've written letters of gratitude to other people, it sparks something in them and in you that's very important. And so there are a number of sort of techniques that we can use, you know, counting our blessings, gratitude, expressing gratitude, acts of altruism, orientating our thinking towards the positive. I don't mean putting that plastic happy smiley face on.
So that's really shifting it away from the disease model, you know, the source, the deep dark source of your unhappiness, and just picking up and doing something about it, actually looking out of yourself.
And I think that's one of the key processes. I think you put your finger on it there. It's the reorientation of attention away from what do I need now in this selfish moment to satisfy my craving, as it were, towards orientating our attention towards the other. For any of us that have been in long-term relationships, we'll know that we have periods where we're satisfied and dissatisfied in our relationships, both at work and with partners. One of the guaranteed ways to increase that dissatisfaction is to keep demanding from the other person that they fix your need. One of the simplest and the easiest ways to increase satisfaction in work or personal relationships is to give that other person exactly what it is that you want. And it's such a simple approach, and it works. And I think it's about orientating our attention away from our pain. And that's not to discount the problem-focused approach. It is not to discount the role that pain and psychological discomfort plays. But it's to say, well, let's have another set of cards that we can play in the game of life. Let's have some other hands that we can play. Thank God psychology has moved to a place now where we're starting to explore the psychology of wellness, and we're starting to give people tools that they can use in their workplace and in their families and with themselves. I hope that we're doing that in a way that doesn't cheapen the meaning-making journey. Those of us that work at the intersection of commercialism, science, and that evangelistic, yo, great feeling, have to tread very carefully that we don't fall into this sort of almost rabid pit of self-promotional sort of I can fix everything in your life that we see at some of the personal development concerts, you know, and that we kind of approach this venture in a sort of in a respectful way.
Well, you can count me in on that game, that new card game, but it sounds like it's also really a whole life's journey, isn't it, Tony?
I think so, and it's nice to be able to be on that journey. I want to
be happy. Professor Anthony Grant founded the Coaching Psychology Unit in the School of Psychology at the University of Sydney. The three-part series of Making Australia Happy was shown on ABC TV. I hope I've made your happiness quotient go up today. And if not, well, stay tuned for This American Life. It's always full of good stories. Speaking of good stories, you may think I'm having you on, but next week I speak to four older women who are very happy with the lives they chose to lead. And guess what? They're nuns. Today's production was by me and Jeff Wood. To download The Spirit of Things, go to abc.net.au/rn/spiritofthings. I'm Rachel Kahn. Do join me next week for Nonsense, a rare look at Mary MacKillop's Girls.